Okay, so tonight is the second in two talks about thinking, and this talk is going to look at the different ways, alternative ways of working with thought during meditation itself, and then looking at five strategies that the historical Buddha recommended for particularly difficult thinking. You know, the kind that just won't let you go. And this was helpful for me giving this talk because I'm dealing with that second part right now. Without going into the details, I was involved in a, I'm a lawyer by trade and I'm representing somebody, so I was involved in this business transaction. And a key person involved in the transaction who's supposed to be neutral, a financial person, we found out had actually been conferring with the other side and helping them craft their offers. And so, you know, their attitude was, well, gee, we didn't do anything. You know, what I'm doing is within the standard of trade, and it's not unethical. And you know, what I was really doing was X. It's a real study in, you know, putting a different name on it. Well, if you have no ethics, maybe it's the American way. You know, from my perspective, it was just outrageous. And it was really interesting because there was something about it that my mind would just not let go of. And, you know, it has something to do with dishonesty, betrayal, you know, a lot of what's happening in politics right now really outrages me, where you know when someone says something that there's no way that they mean that. So that level of duplicity that is becoming more obvious, and the person doing it isn't bothered by it. It isn't bothered by the fact that you know. So, you know, I found that the last couple of days, my mind just keeps going back to that. And I just will not let it go. So a lot of these techniques that we're going to talk about tonight, I mean, I've been really using them. And they're helpful. They're really helpful because if you keep in mind that as a method, one of the things that we're trying to do in practice is to keep the mind in a relative balance so that it can actually direct attention to where we want it to go and then attend to it mindfully, those two things. Your mind has to be in some relative degree of balance to do that. You know, if there's too much energy or if it's too agitated, you can't direct your attention and keep it someplace. And you can't be mindful. You can't hold it there. So it's not a control issue at all. You know, it's not like, well, I'm going to keep my emotions in check. You know, I'm going to keep them in this band of... That's not it at all. Because the whole point is creating the conditions, which here we're talking about the conditions of keeping the mind to the degree that it's possible within a certain range of balance, which is the condition that allows the mind to point the attention and be mindful. So everything's cause and effect. So if you hold on to that balance idea, it really helps because you know, you can be struggling with something, and in the midst of it, because the mind identifies and personalizes, it can be so confusing. But if you go back to some of the basics that we're going to talk about tonight, and you just remember balance. You know, it's like, like, wow, my mind is really out of balance. Okay, that's the first thing I've got to worry about. You know, I'm worrying about this guy and what he did and how angry I am about it, and maybe I've got an anger problem. And well, hey, the first thing is, what do I need to do to get the energy in my body and mind stabilized and in balance so I can actually see what the issue is? That's the whole point. right? This is what the Buddha says, we're always going wrong, is that we're missing what the real issue is. And it's because either our mind is too agitated or that it immediately grabs onto something or wants something, and so it can't see clearly, yeah? All right. So the second idea that I want to throw out as a starting place, and then I'll go into the handout, is in terms of working with a problem, quote, a problem, or an obstacle or a difficulty or an irritation or an annoyance. Those are just all conceptual words. You know, when you bump into something energetically, that's a problem. There's really two different ways that you can approach it. There's a lot of different methods, but there's two ways, two avenues. One avenue is to identify what's there as the thing that needs to be solved. You know, it's a hindrance, an obstacle, it's confusion. That I need to put my attention on that and fix it. The other is that maybe that's not the problem. Maybe the problem is that I'm not doing some of the simplest, most fundamental things using the simplest, most fundamental tools to keep my mind and its attention and its mindfulness in the right place. And so the job is to restore my mind and my attention to a particular place, as opposed to trying to identify something as a problem and fix it. And I'm going to go into that now. But these are two significantly different things. And to the degree that we use the first one, that we define something as an issue, and the way we define it, the way we frame it, creates resistance of any kind, it's much harder to work with than trying to create something positive, like interest or curiosity or some other quality. You know, built into the approach, there's a greater degree of difficulty because the mind directs the intention, and the intention has a certain kind of energy. Well, the energy of resistance of any kind is holding back to some degree. And the energy to create something, to create balance, to create interest, to create curiosity, is the reverse. It's opening the energy and directing it, okay? All right. So what I want to do here is just identify, this is things that we all know or should know about just the most fundamental aspects of Vipassana or insight practice, and I'm going to direct these specifically towards the idea of thinking, okay? We could plug in emotions and other things that are mind states, but all the fundamentals are the same. So the first thing is that this practice is purposeful. So like when we're actually sitting in meditation, there is an intention. And as we know from a Buddhist perspective, intention drives everything, right? And so the purpose or the intention is to actually have a certain kind of experience. And the experience is to experience a particular kind of non-conceptual liberating insight, which releases the mind and the body and the heart from suffering. And when that starts to be released, and to whatever degree it is released, that suffering, we begin to be able to abide without obstruction in peace and deep satisfaction. So that's the long-term intention and purpose, not just of the practice, but of the sitting itself and all the tools that we use to get to that. So, you know, the purpose isn't to be kind to everyone. The purpose is not to have compassion. The purpose isn't to have a balanced mind. Those are all tools or conditions that we work with that lead to liberating insight. Okay? So there's all we want to develop all those things. But it's like the goal isn't to be a good meditator. You have to be a good meditator to have liberating insight. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to have insight. So there's a difference between I'm trying to be a good meditator and I'm trying to be a good meditator in a way that leads to liberating insight. Okay? And so we can kind of get lost with that. You know, we're sitting, you know, it's hot or we're sleepy and we get disconnected from the purposefulness of the practice. Okay? So the fundamental method is to establish and maintain the conditions, which are qualities of mind, the energy in our body, that allow us to directly and mindfully experience and investigate the qualities and characteristics of experience. And I think the thing that from both a practice standpoint and conceptually, that I don't know if it's confusing or gets lost, is that the insight method, as well as the underlying psychology, is primarily somatic, sensory, and kinetic. It's body-based, it's through the senses, and is about the energy and movement of the energy and its expression through the senses or being received by the senses. That's all non-conceptual. That's what we refer to as direct experience. So to the degree that you find yourself in sitting lost in thought, if you are connected with the fact that the practice is somatic and sensory and kinetic, you know that you're in the wrong place. Okay. The qualities of experience are these inherent characteristics. We use words to describe them, but they're non-conceptual experience. And to use a really simple one, if there's a pain in my arm, the pain has a location. It has a size. It may have a depth. It may have an intensity or strength. There may be temperature. It may move. It may be kinetic. It may change. And usually with pain, it always does. So there's a whole series of them. I list out maybe 8 or 10 that are commonly referred to in the footnotes. But, that's the starting place. This is an experientially deconstructional practice where rather than be at the surface experience, oh, I am experiencing pain in my arm. You know, that's an idea that's layered on. I actually go to the experience itself and examine it experientially, without rushing, very calmly, but in real depth, like what actually is being experienced in the body through the sense energetically. Okay. And then the experience has certain characteristics to it. Okay. So it arises and changes on its own. But, you know, if I've got... I didn't decide to make that happen. And as much as I might like to, I'm not going to control it. You know, the temperature, the depth, the movement, all of these different things, the size. Okay? It will keep changing continuously. And it won't stop. And it does that independently. And if I try to resist that, by controlling it, by controlling something I can't change, an inherent characteristic, that it is independent, that is operating on its own, that it literally can't be controlled, it can only be related to. If I don't approach those characteristics and engage them, what I get is suffering. Okay, I get tension, struggle, suffering. So classically, these are called anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Okay, impermanence or temporariness of the experience, it keeps changing. Anatta, that it is not independent. It is conditional and keeps changing. And dukkha, which is tension or struggle or suffering. When I don't relate to the actual nature of that experience. So you just take that and apply it to your breath, the headache that you have, a sensation in your big toe, a desire that you feel in your body, a resistance, whatever it is. So the fundamental method is not relating to an idea or the surface appearance of something, but moving down to this direct somatic sensory kinetic experience. The reason we do that and deconstruct it that way is it depersonalizes the experience. And normally what we do is we relate to the image, the surface image, and it's my experience, and then I'm into thought. I'm actually disconnected from my body, and now I'm struggling with what I've named and think is in my body, but I'm doing it conceptually. And I'm actually not clearly experiencing what's in the body. So I don't have the ability to relate to it of what it's actually there. I'm relating to it through an idea or a concept. So the I'm having a little bit of trouble seeing some of this tonight. When I get tired, my vision gets blurry. I forgot to talk about these guys. Okay, so some of you I know what this is, but this was a picture that was on the internet, I think yesterday or the day before, and this is a newly born brown-throated Australian baby sloth. Okay. And he's adorable, you know. And so, you know, one of the five hindrances, you know, a hindrance, is sloth and torpor. And, you know, a sloth is basically dullness or low energy in the body, and torpor is dullness and low energy in the mind. And so, the Buddha said, well, you know, all negative mind states, all negative mind states have as their origin, arise from one of the five hindrances, you know? So it's like, oh no, sloth, you know, that's a terrible thing. And, you know, the image, and the image I had of sloth up until I saw this, I've never seen a little baby sloth before, was the image of an adult sloth, you know, and they're the reason that the Buddha selected that word is they're so slow. You know, it's almost like it's in slow motion. Yeah. You know? And I've actually seen pictures, I'd heard about this, but I've actually seen pictures where they take a handgun right next to the sloth's ear, fire it, and nothing happens. You know, he's going, not even this. I mean, not even that. This goes back to kind of my opening story about my grandson looking at an experience where I'm really frustrated, and he's saying, geez, Poppy, Grandpa, we're having so much fun, you know. If you're relating to, if the image you have in your mind of sloth is, you know, this, you know, really kind of unpleasant thing that drags you down and is a risk to mindfulness. That creates a certain kind of energy in working with it. But it, like, what if you thought that this was sloth? Like, you know, actually, it's just this cute little thing that's in there, and if I just treat it right, it'll look like this. Rather than, and I'm not joking. You know, I mean, I'm overdoing it a little bit, but this, the whole point, in, you know, the Buddha used the word right, you know, right speech, right view, right intention, right action. And right isn't a moral term. Right means nothing more than right intention points the mind towards liberation, you know, towards equanimousness, and away from desire, aversion, and wrong intention, speech, whatever, is the reverse. It points your mind into suffering rather than away from suffering. So the imagery that we have and what we understand something to be, you know, if we can get away from somehow moralizing it, or more importantly, the reason for this deconstructional approach is personalizing it, we then have a chance of working with it. As long as we keep getting pulled in to identification and personalization, at some level we're stuck, because we've got to get out of that just to work with what we're dealing with. This is the problem. You know, it's like we can't even get to working with the problem because we're stuck in personalization. A huge problem, you know. So to the degree that we can neutralize all of these things, and rather than approaching it with negative energy, approach it with some kind of positive effort of what is possible rather than what is being prevented, you have a much better practice. Okay, so then I was saying, you know, and we all know this, basically the fundamental approach in sitting practice, the focus of attention, is you select a primary object, what we call a primary object of meditation, which is usually in this tradition the breath or the body. And that is the primary focus. If something arises that is has more power to it, is more dominant than that, has more energy in it, a thought, an emotion, or what have you, the attention shifts. The same kind of investigation of the qualities and characteristics, causation with that, and then that, like everything else, will just begin to fade away. And then the attention comes back to the primary object. The value of the primary object is it acts as a stabilizing force. So actually, the primary object itself isn't the importance. The importance is the quality of attention and mindfulness we bring to whatever the primary object is. So, and once again, I'm exaggerating just a little bit, but if you could, if we made our primary object the bottom of our right foot rather than our breath, and you could actually keep your attention in that and be mindful, the value of that would be the same as if you made your primary object the breath or the body or an emotion. The value isn't in the object. The value is in the mindfulness and seeing into the true nature of the qualities and characteristics and causation. Okay. So how does thought play into this? And it's really simple. The basic idea is, to the degree possible, to refrain. It's a protective action to refrain from going into the story or the narrative of thought. And the reason we do that is because it undermines our ability to experience things directly at the somatic, sensory, and kinetic level. And the reason is because thought is conceptual. Because it's conceptual, it separates us from our experience in our body. And the third thing it does is it leads to personalization. So that's the reason in meditation, we try to refrain from it, because it just interferes with the basic thing we're trying to do. You cannot see clearly of what we're trying to see. Here we're trying to see not the surface appearance of things, we're trying to see below that the fundamental nature of experience and how experiences arise, how they dissipate, and how conditions, if they're a certain way, prevent negative states of mind from arising in the future and encourage positive states of mind to arise in the future. That's the fundamental work, okay? So thought interferes with all of that. And, you know, a lot of us like to think. Some of us like to think more than everybody else, but we're thinking all the time. So one way to understand the meditative process is to give the mind a rest from thought. We're just caught in concept, which is symbolic. You know, words and language are symbols for what really exists. You know, like when we say, well, put your attention on the breath. You're not putting your attention on the breath. You're putting your attention on a series of sensory experiences in the body, the soma, and the energy associated with those sensory experiences. Breath is a word for that. So it is not uncommon for people for a long time, for years, when they're in meditation to be relating to an image or an idea of breath and not all those sensations. It's an interesting thing. And it's just that we are so habituated, right, to thinking and defining our experience through thought.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
This is a rookie question, okay.
Those are the best.
So before I started doing this, which is fairly new in this venue or this tradition, the word insight meditation, you know, conjured up, oh, you're going to think about things to come up with insight about, you know, how to do life better. So what I would like to hear, because it sounds like that's actually the opposite, since you're saying not to think, what is the definition of insight according to this practice?
Okay. So insight in this practice is through the process I just described. This experience and observing the qualities and the characteristics and how they arise and pass away. Insight spontaneously arises. While the objective is to have insight, the conditions that I've described of the way we're practicing leads to spontaneous discovery, recognition, insight, you know, whatever you want to call it. But it is spontaneous. It's not like I'm going to sit down and say, okay, you know, in this sitting, I'm going to figure out why I'm so upset at that guy who did that thing, you know, that financial guy. And so if I just, you know, that's not what we're doing. The insights that are presented are about the fundamental nature of experience. They're frequently about these kinds of principles as they relate to relationships, but they're not something that we're creating through conceptual analysis or reflection.
Would you call it an intuition that you get, or is that not?
Well, many in some of the traditional language, they call it intuitive insight. And I think here, for me, there is a real problem with language to begin with here, because we're trying to use Western English words that have all kinds of meanings attached to them, and your question illustrated that, right? You say, well, you know, I thought we were going to have insight, which meant we, right? Yeah, you know, I mean, like, Sometimes I wish we'd just forget, you know, I'd say, we'll call it a banana. You know, we're going to have a banana experience. Then maybe that would be, it's going to be a really important banana, though. The language gets in the way, okay, because even intuition is loaded with all kinds of stuff. So I think the closest we can get, and then you have to have the experience, is that something spontaneously happens as a result of this experiential, investigative relationship that you're having with your body and emotions, and we're relating to them in a different way than we normally do. This is the important part. Normally, we immediately start going into a narrative and laying concept on our experience. Here, we're trying to refrain from that and see it in a different way. So it is a different product because of a different experience that we're having.
I was sharing with someone who has done this practice a really long time, the experience I had when I took the MBSR class.
Uh-huh. Sure.
I was very moved and sad by that. And we had a class right after that, and I felt really emotional. I tend to get pretty emotional sometimes. So we sat down and did some kind of practice where we were just looking outside. And that practice, I was sharing with her that doing that practice changed the whole, it's like I still had all the feelings, but I didn't have the over, you know, getting flooded or overwhelmed by it.
That's right.
She goes, oh, you had an insight. That's what she said to me. So I don't know, you know, I said, oh, is that an insight?
Yeah.
Thing, or
well,
I'm
just going to stick. I know it's a partial description. I'm just going to stick with the description that you gave, okay? So one of the really powerful things about these techniques is that they experientially reframe and contextualize what we're experiencing rather than are trying to think our way into doing that. So, you know, we're really upset about something. We're being flooded. And just by saying that, you know that we've identified with something and it's all become personal, right? Those things are the product of that, right? Yeah. So here, you know, we focus on a tree or a large space or an image of clouds floating through the sky or our own breath. And what happens is that all the stuff that is contracting in our body, all the energy that's contracting and the personalization starts to lessen and starts to fall aside, and then suddenly what we're experiencing feels different. It's like, well, man, there's a bunch of grief there, and there's a bunch of sadness, but it's no longer overwhelming me, you know. And so that's a powerful experience. Recognizing that you had that experience and it was different and how it arose would be a kind of insight. I wouldn't call just having the experience an insight. It's that is just one of the many, many calming, opening, restorative experiences that you have as a result of this product. When we use the term liberating insight, we're talking about insights that go to understanding directly and non-conceptually how and why we suffer. So, assuming that is the definition, what you described is an experience, it's not an insight, okay? Yeah. And once again, I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, like, listen, that's a valuable thing, and if you could cultivate how to do that, right? Man, like, go for it, you know? Sure. Okay. Does that help? No. No. But it'll take a while.
Experience in the tradition to understand exactly.
That's right.
The new idea of what insight is.
Yeah. And my guess is there's a lot of experienced people in the room, and if you ask them what insight is, we'll get a number of different answers, because there's kind of a modern Western idea about insight being suffering that is related to Western psychology. And a lot of those insights appear through this. Not by thinking it through, they just spontaneously appear. So that's a very valuable insight. It's not a liberating insight in the way that we defined it in this tradition. So, as I say, I just wouldn't worry about it. I just practice, and what will happen for all of us is that slowly you start having experiences and it's revealed to you. Yeah.
Okay.
So, the specifics with respect to if you're using a primary object rather than it just being choiceless, just being whatever is coming up that is most dominant, your attention goes there, stays with it until it dissipates, is to use the primary as the stabilizing anchor that you're going back to, that you're watching its characteristics and its qualities. Something's more dominant, you move the, if your attention is pulled away, it's not more dominant than the primary, but it just pulled away, a thought, a sound, what have you. It's important that you notice that and acknowledge that my attention is over here now, not here on the primary object. Because the fundamental idea of practice is that we know what we're experiencing. So my intention was to have my attention and my mindfulness on the primary object. That's not where it is anymore. It's on some bird that's out there, or the sound of exhaust of a car. So this isn't to object to it, to be annoyed by it, or anything else. It's just to see it, to very clearly acknowledge it, and then smoothly escort the attention and mindfulness back to the primary object. Okay, and to the degree possible, to do that with little resistance, negativity, judgment. I think it's quite important to, mindful, when you're actually mindful, your attention is fully in the moment. So there's no idea, there's no sense of like getting someplace or hurrying or getting back to someplace, right? There's no rushing. So I think it's really important that when your attention is pulled over here, that's what happens. It's like the acknowledgement isn't, oh, my attention's over there, I got to get back here. Okay, it's like, okay, I am not doing what I intended to do right now. Okay, now I'm going to do what I intend to do. So that's kind of the fundamental process. So let's go through a number of different scenarios here. So the first one is when the attention shifts to thought, what's the most basic thing? And the most basic thing is to do what I just said. That's the general thing. If it's helpful, some people find it helpful, some people don't, is to just at this point, this is, your mind isn't being constantly pulled away. It's just occasionally being pulled away by thought, okay? It's just to know that, notice it, and just to make a soft, gentle note, thinking, thought, and bring it back. At first it feels artificial, but it can be really valuable because it just objectifies what's going on, that it's a process that's happening. If this isn't like just a ton of this happening, it's not repeatedly yet, one thing that can be very helpful, and then it can be really helpful later if you started it early, is to just note that thinking is taking place, on its own. Whoever you are didn't decide to do that. It just, and not resist it at all. Just allow the primary object to be in the foreground of your attention, where most of your energy is, and that your mind knows that thought or thinking is happening, but it's in the background of the attention. So some attention is being given to that and some effort's being given to that. But it's just an acknowledgement of what is happening. You're not fighting it, and you're keeping your attention primarily in the primary object. And it's an interesting thing if you try this. At first it'll feel like, you know, your mind goes conceptual. Well, my mind can't be in two places at one time, so I'm going to be shifting back and forth. And then if you drop that, and you're just like, pretty soon it's like, you know, it's just not an issue. Okay, you know, my mind's thinking. But it's not an annoyance, it's not an interference. For whatever reason, you know, it's just dumping off a lot of stuff. And so your attention is primarily here. That can be really helpful if later the thinking gets really repetitive, because you've already established that as a base, and it's kind of set a tone for how you're going to relate to it. So what happens if the attention repeatedly shifts to thought, which means that there's something driving it, right? There's some reason for that happening. So this is where I was talking about there's multiple approaches. The first thing that I think is helpful to do, rather than defining that as the issue, the issue being I'm thinking, is to actually look at what you're doing in the meditative process. So the first thing is to examine whether your intention to be purposeful, to follow the method, and to be focused. You know, which we talked about earlier, that there's a specific method we're using, there's a specific way that we're focusing. Am I connected with that? And what you'll find commonly is I'm not connected with that. You know, I've sat down, I've kind of got relaxed, I've gotten calm, my mind shifted over to just wanting to be calm. So I'm just kind of following my breath and feeling well. Well, that's not the purpose, it's not the method, it's not the focus. And it's not surprising that your mind's going to start thinking, and it's going to be difficult to get out of the thinking because of the method you're using. The method doesn't have any intention behind it. It doesn't have any effort to maintain the method and the focus in a particular way. I mean, it's the most fundamental thing. Like, what am I doing? Well, there's a thing that I'm doing over and over and over and over. It's the same thing over and over. There's all kinds of different experiences, but it's the same process. And my experience is that I will find that I'm disconnected with those frequently. My energy goes down, I get disconnected from that. So the second thing that you might look at is what's happening with the energy in your body and in your mind. Because if your energy has gone down, your ability to maintain your attention and to be mindful is compromised. So what happens when the strength of your attention and the strength of your mindfulness is compromised? Your mind starts thinking and wants to go repetitively to thought rather than be in the experience, because being in the direct experience takes some effort to focus and practice. Does this make sense? Okay. So the problem is not the thinking. The thinking is a symptom that our energy has dropped and we need to do something with our energy. It could be that we've got like just too much energy and we're not channeling it. We're not focusing in a concentrated way, which makes it stable. Or we've got too little energy where it's dropped and I can't skillfully pay attention or be mindful, in which case we would bring it up. Okay, so the third one would be, what is the quality and amount of effort being used? And, you know, does it support balanced attention and mindfulness? And the illustration that we always use in the beginning meditation class is, take your palm, take your left hand and put it out. I'm asking you to do this, okay? And then take your pointer finger on your right hand and close your eyes for this one and just barely run it across the top of your hand, your palm, And just notice how much you can feel, how much information you get about the skin, the tendons, what have you. Okay, now press a little bit harder and do the same thing. And notice that the amount and quality or sensitivity of the experience and the information is less. Now press real hard. What happens? You get kind of this dull thing. Yeah, okay. So what'll happen is that, you know, for whatever reason, there's a lot of reasons, we'll start over-efforting when we're sitting. It's the equivalent of this. So we're bringing too much effort, and then what happens traditionally, the way they describe it, is here's the object, the primary object, the breath, and I'm trying to put my attention and my mindfulness on it like this, and it slips off. It won't stay there. You would think it would be the reverse, you know, that like it would be a blanket, but that's not what happens. You know, it slips off, and then in the absence of this quality relationship and connection with the primary object, the mind starts thinking. Okay? So you've got to pull back on the effort. And the reverse could be opposite. It's kind of what I described earlier. A common experience that people will have is they'll be feeling, man, I'm just having a fabulous sitting. My mind is so clear and alert, and you know, I've got good energy, and I can see all these sensations in the in-breath and the out-breath, and I can see things changing. And then, like, almost like this, almost like, boom, I don't see any of that anymore. It's experienced sometimes like almost like kind of a white noise space. And your mind's fairly alert, but all of that experience disappears. And the reason is that this experience, which is pretty exciting, also is very calming. And so the effort that is being used to maintain attention and mindfulness starts backing off because it's pleasant, and then it gets to a level where it just drops off. Actually, it's fairly close to going into sloth and torpor because of the pleasantness, okay? And then when that goes back, you're not in connection with the object, so there's no experience. What happens? Your mind starts thinking. So in all of these illustrations, and you think this is a bunch of illustrations, right? The issue is not thinking at all. Thinking is the symptom for you to look at the purpose, the method, and the focus of what you're doing. Okay, so that would be one approach you could use when there's repeated shifts to thought. Another thing that you could do is you could make the noting a little more detailed so that the interest level in the mind and the curiosity goes up, which is going to increase the effort. So rather than just going thought, thinking, you could do notes which relate to the time relationship. So you could past, present, future. You know, remembering, thinking, planning. So most of the time, we're thinking about something in the past or something in the future. Unless we're actually working on something, it's seldom, particularly in meditation, to be thinking about the present moment. But those would be the designations. So it's just enough to kind of bring the interest and curiosity up, not to go into the content. I mean, you know, you're going to look at a thought and you'll know instantaneously if it's about the past or the future. I mean, you don't have to go through some big analysis, right? But it's just enough where the mind is engaging it with a little more interest and curiosity and definition, and that may be enough to brighten up the mind and help you come back. The last one here that I put a little star on it?
Yeah.
Okay. This little innocuous one line is the one that I find to be the single most helpful and important. And it's about refocusing attention and mindfulness. And so if I find that my mind is repeatedly going back to thinking, I will notice that my mind has moved, that it's at the the bottom of page 2. Okay, single sentence. I'll acknowledge that the mind has moved. I'll acknowledge that I am doing something that other than I intended to do, and then I will go into my body and examine sensations and make the sensations the primary attention. And the same process, you know, look at their qualities and characteristics, and then when that dissipates, go back to the primary object. For me, and I'm not saying this is works for everybody, but for me, this over a long meditation career has proven to be very, very helpful because it you're being very clear about the thinking, and then you're redirecting the attention and the mindfulness into an object which is tangible. And you have a much greater chance of experiencing it and examining it. And so to the degree that you can get that going, it changes the entire sitting, because the degree to which you're in direct experience increases significantly. I find that if I'm repeatedly thinking and I note the thinking, and even my mind is strong enough to bring it back to the primary object, and then it's going to get pulled off again, that I start losing the, I really have to up my effort to really carefully attend to and experience the primary object. But here, when I move down into the body, it creates an interest and a curiosity level in the mind. That, at least for me, has been very productive. So I would encourage you to try that. Okay, so let's say that we're not only having repeated thoughts, but it becomes continuous, you know, that, you know, these maddening things where you just cannot get back to the primary object. So once again, this is illustrative of the two different ideas. The first one would be to see the thinking as a as the symptom, and to work on strengthening your interest and curiosity in the primary object. And this kind of relates to that you've gotten disconnected to the amount of effort and energy that you're spending on the method, and the focus and the purpose has gone down. So different ways that you could do that is you could look for something that you've not seen or experienced before or during that sitting in the primary object, so that, you know, there's actually a curiosity factor. You could focus specifically on causation. And there's a footnote. So you're specifically watching for how does a sensation arise? You know, when does that sensation come up, and what immediately preceded it? How does it change? You know, what is the experiential thing that's happening? Why does it start to dissipate experientially? So that's a whole different way. It's a more sophisticated, it requires more effort, and it's much more interesting if it starts to work than, well, there's a sensation, there's another sensation, there's another sensation. So you could focus just on the qualities, you could focus just on the characteristics. And there's a footnote there that shows you how you could use the breath just to focus exclusively on the characteristics. So there's a myriad different ways that you can work with the breath. I mean, these ones right here, if you decided to actually practice with those, and I mean, you could take a week for each one of those things. I mean, that's 6-8 weeks worth of practice to discover what works for you, which in the end is what this is all about, right? It's like we actually want to move forward in terms of our ability to see into the nature of our experience. And that's the reason there are these different techniques. Different techniques work for different people. And once you reach a certain level of practice, you want to expand your capacity and your toolbox, your skill level. So that's one. The The other is you could focus on the thought itself and notice and note that it has certain characteristics. So you're actually looking at the thought and noticing that each thought is temporary and that it's constantly changing. That becomes an actual focus of meditation. That's what you're focusing on. that it appears and disappears spontaneously on its own. You know, you're not thinking that. They just keep happening. And that if you resist that, that it creates tension and you start to struggle and you suffer in one way or another. So those could become, or one of them could become, the way that you focus on the thinking. Okay. All right, so then what would happen if none of the above worked? So the traditional recommendations are, first of all, just get out of there, shift to a different form of meditation, or to a different form of mindful practice. So, you know, the one that you hear the most is shift to loving kindness practice. If it's becoming you're kind of beating yourself up, you know, which happens, or you feel beat up by the thinking, the content of the thinking, compassion practice as opposed to metta practice may be real helpful. And so rather than just always going to metta, understanding the difference between those two practices, I give you some footnotes for things you can go to and experiment. I mean, like, what actually helps? You know, that's what helps you to get back in balance. And then finally, the very last, let's say that doesn't even work, well, you switch to one of the Buddha's five strategies. And that really, you know, this is going to be short, it really deserves a whole talk on its own. But the five strategies are listed here. And the first one is that you replace the thought that's present with its opposite. And what he's talking about is the mind state quality. So if it's an angry thought, angry thinking, resentful thinking, that you replace it with thinking that is kind or compassionate. And not general, but specific. So, you know, that could be that in the illustration that I gave, you know, this person who did what I perceived as unethical conduct and was having trouble letting it go. It could be that I'm specifically focusing on that person in a kind and compassionate way. You know, that there was a legitimate, I don't understand it, but there was a legitimate intention. You know, the person thought they were being helpful. They were trying to do the right thing. They may have been misguided. I may disagree with it, but I can see that that's part. So it could be at the person themselves, or it could be just shifting the tone. So I'm thinking angry thoughts. I'm going to start thinking about my grandson. Uh-huh. And the experience that I had yesterday with him that, you know, just lit me up with love. So if you find that you start thinking about the object that is causing you the problem, and it's just a struggle to make that shift, don't struggle. Shift to something that will actually do this. Replace the angry motivated thoughts with some kind and compassionate thoughts. Okay? Unskillful, skillful. Wrong, right. You may notice that in sitting or in daily life, you know, you'll start thinking about something that somebody did, and it like it's an anger-based, an aversion-based thought pattern. It's anger-based, and you're thinking about, I'm thinking about this guy, and then what'll happen is just spontaneously, I'll realize I'm not thinking about him anymore. I'll think about something else that pissed me off. And it's not random. This is the point. If you actually look at it, the reason the mind is shifted to that is that it has the same underlying emotional base. So it's fascinating. You know, I said that, like, that. Well, one of the things that must be behind my, I'm still not clear about it, other than it being unethical, but that's way too simple, you know. The other images that started coming up all had to do with people saying presenting themselves as one person and then being something else unethically. All the images that came up, you know, all spontaneous. I didn't intentionally think of one of them, you know. And then the reverses, like this, and I'll use this thing with my grandson frequently because it's just such an easy source for me at the moment, that I'll shift over and I'll think about him, and then the same thing will happen. I'll start having these really, like, expansive, oceanic, warm feelings, and experiences and people will come up from my past that have that same emotional base. You know, I'm not trying to make those come up. It's just that once you start to touch that, it opens the door and they start presenting themselves. So this first technique, you know, if you practice it a little bit, experiment, man, very powerful stuff, very helpful. The second one is reflecting on the negative consequences of unskillful thought. You know, this is a little more analytical, a little harder, and it's basically, you know, I'm really being hard on this guy, and I'm actually hurting myself. You know, these kinds of thoughts are not right thoughts. They're not skillful thoughts. They're not productive. What I'm doing is practicing anger. You know, I'm not sitting here doing some kind of thoughtful, analytical effort to try to solve the problem. I'm just pissed off, and I just want to keep churning that this guy did the wrong thing. Well, you have to figure out a way that you can do that without making that process just churn you up more. That's really the key. And for me, that takes some work, and if you're going to use that technique, you really have to experiment with it and figure out how to use it. Okay. The next one is redirecting attention away from the unskillful thinking. So you'll see this a lot in kind of pop psychology books, and it's basically, well, you're in a tough you start thinking about a very difficult situation. Well, you think about some other situation that's not difficult that makes you feel good. The Buddha actually recommended this. And all of these strategies are for when you're really having a tough time and you know, we're using something to pull ourselves out of it. My own experience of this is I need to have that experience, whatever it is, kind of pre-programmed. Because if I'm like really depressed, really angry, really anxious, really fearful, for me, in that moment of collapse and identification, just to spontaneously come up with the opposite that's going to make me feel good, I'm not one of those people who can do that. Maybe some people can, I can't. So I have kind of like a little bag of experiences that where, you know, I believe that I was confident. I believe that I was kind. I had a particular kind of experience. And so when something like this comes up, I can move to that and recreate it and feel it in my body. Reflecting on the causes, once again, this is a much more analytical thing. I think your mind has to have a certain amount of coolness to it. I mean, like, why am I so upset over this? You know, and you're kind of taking that apart, trying to depersonalize it. And then the final one, I really like this, subduing or overpowering the unskillful thought. And the image in the sutta is of a large man taking a small man and putting him on the ground and sitting on top of him. So this is basically, and you know, it's funny, but you know, it's an important one. Because I am confident that every person in this room knows that there are certain thoughts that they start to think that are not good for them to think. They're dangerous. They're actually dangerous. And they're just not productive. I mean, there's just no value in them because they have something to do with self-judgment, self-criticism, shame, guilt, whatever it may be. And so having a strategy of, I'm going to use one of these, when the, every time it, that starts to come up, you know, I'm going to work with it. And one of the strategies is when it feels really powerful, because sometimes they do. I mean, they feel like, you know, if I'm not careful, this is just going to overtake me today. I'm going to go into a panic attack, or I'm going to be guilty all day. But that you just have a resolve that, like, I am not going there. That's what this is talking about, that kind of a power. I am not going to go there. I am not going to think about this. I am in opposition to that. Now, that kind of goes against everything I've already said, right? You know, the practice about being open and kind and, you know, non-judgmental. Well, there's sometimes where we have to, like, just absolutely protect ourselves. And that's what that illustration is. I'm not going to allow my mind, that thought, to injure me today. So, okay, so I hope, I tried to put this together, and I tried to put together in a way that it was something that you could actually use as a reference. And if you wanted to experiment with different ways of working with thought, that there was an order, and there was an order of when it might be helpful to use them. And I've tried to give you a bunch of footnotes of that may be helpful. I hope they are. So if you have any questions about this, want to talk about it, you know, send me an email, whatever it may be. I think it's an important topic, and I'd be glad to help you if I can. So, okay. Listen, thank you very much for coming tonight. It's an interesting thing that I said this the last time I spoke, that we are certainly all bound by these fundamental things of being born and dying and the struggle that occurs in between. And one of the things that oddly we're not bound by is happiness. Because there are so many people in the world that are suffering at such a deep level that even the simplest form of happiness and satisfaction can't seep through. It's just a terrible notion that exists in the world. So, and that's part of the reason I think our practice is so important, because it not only helps us and supports everybody in the room, but in some real way, there's many different Buddhist beliefs about this, that there's an energetic field in the universe, and our intention contributes to that, and in some tangible way, it may be hard to see or describe, but in some tangible way, actually contributes to the possibility and the conditions that people all over the globe may have the possibility of experiencing some happiness and being free. So, thank you very much. I believe that to be true, and I hope that our efforts make that true. Okay. Thank you very much.